All right, first question. I know that most of you in this room are theorists. How many experimentalists here? One. So by experimentalists, I mean really like if you spend like your mornings and afternoons and nights in the lab. Good, okay, there is one. All right, so I'm very happy to be here today and to present one of our latest results. This work was actually done when I was in Vienna, so I will start with just a few words about me, just to give you an idea of why I'm here speaking today. So I did my thesis in Florence. I worked on generation of squeezed states of light. Then I moved to the University of Vienna, where I worked on different things. I work on generation and detection of multipartite entanglement, and then I switched to quantum reinforcement learning, and this is what I'll be talking about today. And then I moved to MIT for my postdoc, where I started working on color centers in silicon, and now I recently switched back to machine learning applications to quantum systems, in particular to color centers in silicon. So I hope that gives you an idea. So as I said, I'm going to focus on the work we did during my PhD. It was a collaboration between Vienna and MIT. All right, so let's start with posing some questions, which we'll get the answer to during the talk. So first of all, why are we interested in machine learning? Well, I guess if you're here, you already know the answer, but still I'm going to go through that. And what is the role of quantum mechanics in all of that? And when I ask this question, I really mean, can we at all quantize machine learning protocols? What does it mean to actually quantize machine learning, and what kind of advantages we can get? And also, because I'm an experimentalist and I work with photons, the question is also, how can we implement quantum machine learning protocols on quantum platforms, specifically with photons. So I'll also get to that. All right, so where does the hype come from? Again, if you're here in this room, I guess you probably know. I guess we're all hyped about this. So you know, like, that in the past few years, there has been really like a lot going on in the field of machine learning. Basically, today is used for everything, right? Spam, email classification, healthcare, news recommendations, whatever, like they mastered the game of Go. This is actually a very cool paper without human knowledge. It's also used for fraud detection in particle physics, in astrophysics, and there's many, many more applications out there. So yeah, I guess this gives an idea of why we're interested in machine learning and what the potential of machine learning is. But now let's ask ourselves, why are we considering quantum systems, and if it's useful at all to consider quantum systems? So I'm taking a step back, and as you may know, building a quantum computer in the lab is not an easy task. If you want to build a useful quantum computer, it's even more of a challenge. And this is because it mainly requires two things. So first of all, we need accurate control over very small systems, which is in general very difficult to achieve in the lab, although, I mean, we do that. We kind of know how to do that nowadays. But also we need to preserve quantum coherence through many computational operations. So we would need eventually error correction. And this is still a challenge that many groups are trying to tackle. So that being said, well, we can come to the conclusion that realizing a large fault-tolerant quantum computing is still a challenge. What we have today, we are dealing with NISQ devices, right? So small quantum systems, which are noisy, so they're probably not the best, but actually, they are enough to test quantum advantages on a small scale. And why am I now talking about this, and how does this connect to machine learning? Well, it's because machine learning, and in particular also like optimization, right? It basically probably provides a good algorithm, a good problem that can be relatively easily implemented on small quantum systems that we can work with nowadays. So I think, at least from my personal perspective, that's also why many experimentalists are interested in trying machine learning protocols on experimental platforms. All right, so what we do, what do we want to do? We want to combine machine learning and quantum computing, so we want to study what happens at the intersection between both, right? So how do we interpret this? It can go both ways. So we can use machine learning for quantum, so we can use machine learning to do many things, actually. So we can describe, for example, the internal state of a system, we can discriminate between quantum states, we can learn phase transitions in many-body quantum systems, and many, many more applications. But we can also use quantum mechanics to enhance, to boost machine learning. And this is, in particular, what I'm going to focus on in the rest of my talk. So we can use quantum computing to speed up, for example, a robot's decision-making process or even its learning process. So it always goes both ways, and we can actually... So quantum computing and machine learning can benefit from one another. Probably you're all familiar with this. I was actually not sure whether to put this slide or not, but I assume so. So I'm gonna go very, very quickly here. So as you know, machine learning is part of artificial intelligence. It can be classified into three main paradigms. So we have supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning, which will be the main focus of my talk. So for supervised learning, we all know that one of the main tasks is, for example, data classification, so discriminate between images, for example, of cats or dogs or whatever. Then unsupervised learning can be used, for example, for anomaly detection, because it can, for example, find patterns in data. So this is useful in fraud detection applications. And then the last paradigm is called reinforcement learning. I'm gonna spend a little bit more time on this because it's the main focus of this talk, so if you already know, you will probably get bored for the next slide, but I guess it's okay. So reinforcement learning is based on an exchange of feedback between an agent and an environment. So it actually does not rely on data like supervised learning and unsupervised learning do. So it's kind of a different way of approaching machine learning. So in one slide, of course, that this slide doesn't contain everything we should know about reinforcement learning, but it gives you an idea of what it is. So let's assume we have an agent. You can think of it as, okay, it's usually always sketched as a cute robot in papers, but I mean, it's obviously like whatever, like algorithm is capable of learning something. So it's an algorithm that is capable of adjusting its behavior in order to work towards the accomplishment of a goal, right? And then the environment is simply the external world the agent is placed in. So it's what the agent sees and perceives all around itself. Now, reinforcement learning consists of mainly three steps. So let's assume that the agent is provided with a certain goal. And let's make it very, very easy. It has to find maybe, let's say, the way out of a maze. And now, like, the last move is whether it should go left or right to find the exit, right? So it's a very, very easy example. So the first step is, so formally, okay, theorists say the environment sends the agent a percept, which means simply that the agent perceives the world around itself. So it sees the road, it sees the walls, it's actually what the agent sees, right? So let's put it in more formal terms. We say that the agent receives a perceptual input from the environment, and according to this input, it performs an action. So now the action is the move that the agent makes. So if the move is, for example, going left or right, well, the agent will decide based on what it sees, now I will go left or I will go right. And then what happens is that if the agent performs the correct action, then the environment rewards the agent. If not, then the environment can punish or actually do nothing to the agent. And what's important here is that this reward that the environment gives the agent on a certain action increases the probability that the agent performs well again at the next round of interaction. So that's why we talk about reinforcement learning, right? So every time the agent receives a reward, the probability of the agent, for example, going left because that was the right move is increased. And then if we keep iterating over these three steps, eventually the agent will have maximized its winning probability, so it will have learned, it will have accomplished the task. So that's why it's called reinforcement learning. And now the main idea that we had was, okay, can we get something out of this if we somehow include quantum mechanics in the reinforcement learning framework? And the answer is yes. Those are actually some works that somehow date back to a few years ago. This was, I believe, mainly initiated by Hans Briegel in Innsbruck, but many other groups took on the challenge and continued performing experiments. So this is not meant to be in any way a picture of what's going on in the field. Of course, it's just a few ideas that I'm putting down here. So as I said, in reinforcement learning, we have two entities. One is the agent and one is the environment. So it comes maybe naturally to ask ourselves what happens if we quantify, if we make one quantum or if we make, so for example, the agent quantum or the environment quantum or both quantum. So we can play around, right? We can play with different combinations. So for example, the first, maybe the easiest way to start this would be to, for example, keep the agent classical and quantize the environment. And if I have time, I'm going to show you this. So this was an experiment, not an experiment, it's still like a theory work, but it actually shows that we can use classical learning techniques to face quantum tasks. For example, we can design new quantum experiments using reinforcement learning. So this is an example of how we can quantize the environment and still keep the agent classical. And then obviously the second step would be, now let's keep the agent, the environment classical, but let's quantize the agent. And what happens is that it was demonstrated both, this is a theory paper and this was the experimental paper, it was done with trapped ions. So they demonstrated that in this case you can actually get a quadratic speed up in the agent's decision time. So what does that mean? It means that the agent can decide faster on the move that it wants to output, which is already quite something, because this is something you don't have if you only consider both of your entities classical. And now, well, I guess you can guess what the next step is. So we both consider both the agent and the environment quantum, and then we see what happens, right? So there was a theory paper that was published on this, and we implemented the experimental demonstration, and we found out that we can actually speed up not even like just the decision time of the agent, but we can actually speed up the entire learning process. And what I mean by that is that we can reduce the number of interactions that the agent has with the environment in order for the agent to accomplish a task. So this is what I'm gonna talk about in the next slides. So as you see, as I said before, we can use in this case machine learning for quantum, so to aid in quantum tasks, for example, designing new experiments, or we can use quantum mechanics for machine learning, so we can boost the performance of machine learning using quantum computing. All right, so maybe it's a question that you already asked yourselves. Also, feel free to interrupt me anytime if you have any question. But so what is actually quantum in the agent and environment? This is something that I asked myself when I started working on this. I was like, what does it mean to actually quantize them? So if we remember this slide about what reinforcement learning is, I was saying the agent and environment exchange signals, which are called percepts, actions, and rewards, right? And this is just, of course, the completely classical picture. But now if we want to quantize the framework, what we can do, we can promote these percepts, actions, and rewards to quantum states. The theorists will forgive me. It's, of course, a little bit more complicated than that. But essentially it boils down to this. So we promote these signals to quantum states, and then what happens? It happens that if now we're dealing with quantum states, we can also deal with arbitrary superposition of these quantum states. So now the big deal is that the agent and environment can use not anymore just a classical channel to communicate, but also a quantum channel, right? So they can exchange these signals in a quantum superposition. And maybe, why does this offer an advantage? Maybe it's not clear now, but let's see. Grover algorithm, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. I assume, how many of you are familiar with the Grover algorithm? Like everyone? I mean, it's good, I can skip some slides. Okay, all right. I'm gonna be then very, very quick. I'm gonna go very quickly through the slides. So, well, okay, as you know, if you start with n elements and you want to find certain target elements, let's say x2, like a win state, what you do, the first step is that you prepare an initial superposition of all your elements, right? And then you can also define a state that is orthogonal to the target element. So it's the state that includes everything but x2, which is your win state. And so you can geometrically represent this. You can have two axes. One is the win state, which is the element you want to find, and the other one is the orthogonal state that contains everything but the win state. And what you do, you start with an initial superposition of all your elements, so you will be somewhere relatively close to the loose state. So the first step in Grover is to apply the so-called oracle. It's an operator, and the effect that this has is to just flip the sign of the winning state. So you see that I'm going from this initial superposition to this one here, where the number where the sign of the win state is flipped. And geometrically, you can also see it as a reflection about the loose axis. So I go, my vector goes from here to here. And then the second step is I apply a so-called reflection to this state. And geometrically, what happens is that this vector now moves from here to here, and you see that it's closer to the win state compared to the initial state, right? So I'm getting there, at least I'm closer. And you see this mathematically because you see that the amplitude of the win state is actually increased compared to the amplitudes of all the other states. So you're basically increasing the probability of finding the win element. And so this is all together, as you know, one Grover iteration. And then I can perform many of these iterations, right, until I find myself relatively close to the win state. And then I can say that I found the win element. And then obviously I can keep playing, but then when this happens, I keep moving away, so I will keep like reducing again the probability. So I also want to be smart enough that I want to stop playing Grover once I reach once I find the win state. And as you all know, how many Grover steps do we need to find the win state? So it goes like square root of n trials, where n is the number of elements. So I need square root of n to maximize the winning probability. Okay, so the Grover algorithm actually offers a quadratic speedup over just a classical search algorithm where I would need n trials. All right, so why am I now talking about the Grover algorithm? It might sound a little bit disconnected, but if we now go back to reinforcement learning and we do a brief recap, so the agent can basically use the Grover algorithm to find the correct moves, the correct actions faster. So I was saying before, the agent has to decide which action to output, right? And one of them, for example, would be the right one. So this boils down to a search problem where the agent has to search for the correct move. So we can rephrase everything in terms of the Grover algorithm, for example. So we can make the agent play the Grover algorithm, and in this case, it will get the quantum advantage that comes from the Grover algorithm. So that means that we can just, if we really want to simplify this, and we needed to simplify it because we needed to perform the experiment, which was already challenging by itself. So in really, like in the simplest terms, you can just define the correct action as your target element that you want to find, and you just say, this is my state one, I will call it one. And then all the other elements, which would correspond to the wrong actions, I can just label them with zero. So I really, what I have, I can just prepare an initial superposition of one and zero with a certain probability, which is arbitrary, which I can decide in the beginning. So I can prepare something like this. And now the task of the agent is to, for example, maximize the this probability such that the agent will always find the one state. So how do we experimentally encode the one and zero state, and how do we create this this superposition? I told you already, I work with photons, so it's actually quite easy to implement a qubit using photons. So we can use this is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, which basically behaves as a tunable beam splitter. So I can label, for example, my modes where the light can propagate with, for example, zero is the upper mode and one is the bottom mode. And I can, for example, input a photon here and I can tune these parameters such that in the end I'm left with a certain superposition of zero and one. So the photon will be in the superposition of these two modes. If you're interested at all, I'm not sure how interested you are in seeing how this actually works in the lab or how it looks like in the lab. Well, that's how it looks like in real life, so you can really see that this is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer where you can, those are waveguides, these solid lines here. And obviously, in order to perform the experiment, you don't need one, but you need many of these. So this was actually quite a big deal when this chip was fabricated a few years ago. It's quite impressive. So this is like, or it was, really a big deal. It was a big technological advance in the field of integrated photonics. So at this point, what we want to do is we want to use this integrated chip to just apply to perform our experiment, right? So it's what I was talking about. So what we can do, we can divide this chip into three regions, and we say one corresponds to the agent, the other one is the environment, and then back to the agent. And you have to pay attention to these labels here. So you see like that 0A and 1A corresponds to the wrong and the right actions. It's what I was saying before. And we also have another qubit. So in total, we have a four-level system. So we have another qubit which has to play the reward. So this R stands for reward, and 0 and 1, it means no reward or reward. So we can start with inputting, for example, a photon from here, from this mode. And we can use this beam splitter here to just prepare what I was saying before. So to just prepare the initial superposition of right state and wrong states. So I'm creating the conditions to apply my Grover search. And then what I can do, I can use two more of these beam splitters to now put. So you see that I'm creating a superposition of 0 and 1 because the photon ends up here, and this corresponds to 0A and 1A, right? So I have a superposition of both 0 and 1, but the reward qubit is still the same. So now what I can do is I can also put the reward qubit in a superposition. So I can now use another beam splitter to prepare a superposition here of 1 reward and 0 reward. So you see that now I have my reward in a superposition, and I have the same down here, right? And then what I can do, I can apply the oracle, and as I said before, the effect of applying the oracle in the Grover search is to flip the sign of the correct action. So you see it here. And this step is played by the environment. So the environment is somehow telling the agent this is wrong or this is not wrong, but the agent actually doesn't know yet. I will get to that. And then eventually I can again like remove the superposition from the reward, and I can apply the last step of Grover to increase the probability that the agent finds the photon in the state one. And eventually I can measure where my photon ends up, so I can basically collapse the wave function using two detectors here, right? But now the thing is that wherever the agent measures the photon here, either in this mode or in this mode, if you see here, so these two modes correspond to both having zero rewards. So the agent actually does not know whether it's performing correctly or not, if that makes sense. So the agent did something, so the probability of this state was increased, but what does it mean? Now the agent needs to learn, so it needs to update this probability. But the agent doesn't know because these two modes correspond to both the zero reward case. So what we did was we actually used the output that comes from this quantum round, and we use it in a completely classical scenario. So now completely classical, it means I have no quantum superposition. It's just like a completely classical picture. So again, for example, if I measure my photon here in this mode, I can input the photon here and test it, right? And then the photon will just go straight because it's just fully classical and will end up here in detector D1, which corresponds to zero reward. If instead I had measured my photon down here, now I can input it again and test it. And now what will happen is that the photon will end up in the bottom waveguide. So this corresponds to the state one reward. So in this case, so the agent actually gets a reward and knows what to do. And if the agent actually measures a reward, then can now update the initial probability to a certain epsilon prime according to a certain update rule, which we can choose, and can start a new round, this time preparing this new state, where now the probability is slightly more here. And then doing this over and over again, the agent can maximize this epsilon, so it can always, so eventually it can find the correct action one, which means that the photon will always end up in the bottom mode. And so this is exactly what I said. So the agent alternates between quantum and classical rounds. And if you see, so this is the experimental results that we measured. So this is the average reward versus the number of rounds. So you see that if the agent follows a completely classical strategy, so like no Grover played, no quantum features at all, this is the learning curve. So you see that it takes a certain number of rounds to increase the winning probability. But instead, if the agent plays this quantum strategy, actually this hybrid strategy, right, this alternation between quantum and classical, then you see that here in this region, the learning curve is steeper, right? And then you see that it goes down again, which is a problem. I don't know if you were expecting that. It actually makes sense, but I had to think a little bit about why this was happening. But let's say for now that the most important thing is that in the beginning here you have a steeper curve, which means the agent is learning faster compared to the completely classical strategy. So to fix this problem of this drop, so why does this happen? It happens because we keep playing Grover and we don't stop. And I was saying before that if you keep playing, you start moving away again from the winning state. So you are losing it again. So in order to avoid this, we can combine this way of playing that I showed you so far, and we can also combine it with a fully classical strategy. So we say as soon as the maximum point is reached and the agent is about to decrease again the probability of success, we switch to a completely classical strategy such that the agent will still keep playing. And you see here that now there we have it. So you can see that there is an advantage in this green line compared to the fully classical strategy. And so you can see that, of course, this leads to a reduction in the learning time because we need less rounds to increase the winning probability. It depends on how you choose it, right? So for example, you say, if I choose this probability to be a certain number, 0.396, I can have a 63% reduction in learning time compared to the fully classical case. But this is, it depends, again, on how you choose this, this probability. So there is, anyway, an advantage. All right, so that's what I wanted to show you regarding this reinforcement learning, so this advantage in the learning time that we demonstrated. And I think I have 10 more minutes to also show you something that I did not work on. It was done in 2018, but it's actually very, very interesting. So I'm always happy to talk about this because I find it a really, really nice work. So I wanted to focus on now using machine learning for quantum, so for designing quantum experiments. So we are here at the point where we keep the agent classical, but we quantize the environment. So this is actually pretty simple, yet I find it extremely nice. So suppose that we are in a lab and we want to create a specific type of entangled state, which is complex. By complex, I mean high-dimensional, multi-particle states. So these entangled states are not easy to generate in the lab. And even before that, it's actually not easy to figure out which components you need to get such a state. So we need to figure out the specific optical components, and it's not always easy. At least, actually, it's almost never easy. And now the thing that these authors ask themselves is, what if we assign this task to a machine? So can machine learning help us in this? And the answer was yes. So they envisioned basically a robot. Obviously, it was an algorithm on their computer, so there was nothing actually happening in the lab. So they say, let's suppose we have an agent which chooses a certain optical element and places it on an optical table. So this is the action that the agent is performing. Of course, this generates a certain state which is analyzed by the environment. So the quantum state is characterized, and then if the quantum state is the correct one, is the one that we wanted to achieve, so if the experiment is successful, then a reward is given to the agent. And then this is iterated over and over again until the agent knows which elements to place to generate a certain target state. I'm gonna skip this because this is just details. So this is what I wanted to show you. So here they decided to plot the length of experiment versus the number of times they repeated the experiment. Let's say they wanted to generate a certain entangled state. They were using the Schmidt rank vector to classify the entangled states, but it doesn't matter. So let's say this is a certain type of complex entangled states. So you see here that the success probability in the beginning is, of course, zero because the agent has no clue what elements to place on the table, and then it starts placing elements, and then it starts receiving rewards, and then it starts to increase the winning probability until it's maximized, right? So we can say that after, let's say, 50 times 10 to the 3 experiments, the agent has maximized the winning probability. So we now know that we are generating this specific type of complex state. And also, one of the things that the others wanted to do, they wanted to also generate an experiment using not a lot of components. So they wanted to reduce the length of the experiment. And there was also a task that they assigned to the agent. And they saw that the agent is also learning, while maximizing the success probability, it's also learning to choose less and less optical elements to generate this 3-3-2 state that they wanted to achieve. And then it was also surprising to see that actually this is also useful to create new states, so that this learning is beneficial to create new states that the agent hasn't received a training for. So if, let's say, now the agent has learned to successfully generate these 3-3-2 states, and now we want to give it the task of generating another type of complex entangled state, which is, for example, the 3-3-3 state, actually you see that of course, the initial success probability drops to zero again, right? Because it's starting again from scratch, but then it goes up relatively quickly. And they also showed a plot where if this training doesn't happen, then the success probability doesn't go up that quickly. So definitely, this training that the agent receives is beneficial also for new experiments, and I find this particularly cool. So, of course, it's not only reinforcement learning that we should consider. There's also a bunch of protocols for supervised and unsupervised learning, as you may all know. I'm not going to go through them, but just if you're interested, I put here some references. At least that's some of the papers I read to understand more what's going on in the field. So conclusions, we can use machine learning and we can use quantum mechanics in both ways. We can embed quantum algorithms in machine learning frameworks if we wanted to try prove a quantum advantage. We can also use classical machine learning in quantum experiments. Of course, that's not it, right? There's still tons of possibilities to explore, and obviously not only with photonics, and also there's a lot going on in theory, so I'm curious to see what the future will bring. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for a beautiful talk. Any questions or comments?
Hi. First off, great, very accessible talk. Really enjoyed it. Could you go to your slide where you hybridized your classical and quantum and you had those two plots? Yeah, this one. So,
sorry.
So there's a regime where the combined strategy is better, but in long time they converge. So can you comment on potentially a context or a situation in which you need, or maybe you're limited to only a few training epochs, that this method would be the one you would want to reach for?
Yeah. So basically, this boils down to real applications, I guess, or. Yeah, so obviously this is, okay, so there's two points. First of all, I said that Grover gives a quadratic speedup. We are not getting a quadratic speedup in this case. And this is because the size of the integrated chip is limited, so we cannot keep, you only have a certain depth. For that, you will need probably like in a few years, you will have longer chips, I don't know, but you can only play one step. And then if that happens, you cannot achieve a quadratic speedup because you have to play like one step at a time. So ideally, if you could actually implement this on a longer chip and you could actually get a quadratic speedup, then I could see that that would be a big advantage, right? Also for like realistic applications. Obviously, in this case, the advantage is not enough such that I would say, I mean, I cannot tell you, oh yeah, like there is a specific application like where I only need maybe like 100 and this is useful.
Right.
It's, yeah. Proof of principle.
Okay. Second, just like real quick follow-up question. You showed a chip at some point in your presentation. Is the data for these plots coming from an implementation on real hardware or on a simulator?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It comes from the implementation on the chip, on the actual chip. So where was it? Here. Yeah, so we were actually inputting single photons, somewhere here, and then we were processing, we were implementing quantum gates on these photons, and then we were decoupling, so outcoupling the photons here, going to detectors, and we had a feedback loop established. Yeah, it's everything on hardware. Yes.
That's very cool. I'm a little unfamiliar with photonics, but does that 26 spatial modes correspond to 26 qubits?
No, 26 spatial modes corresponds to 26 waveguides, so the qubits, it depends on how you want to encode them. If you do like path encoding, you can use two waveguides to create, for example, one qubit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you for the nice talk. In agent quantum and environment quantum case, is agent's quantum state analogous to the neural network itself in classical case?
Well, sorry, what was the first thing? Was analogous to a neural network?
Agent's quantum state is analogous to the neural network in the classical case.
The agent quantum state? What?
Yes.
Oh, no. Although at least not in this case. Not in this case. But there's like other protocols where they quantize the agent. I actually thought about this, not for this. So they basically treat the internal memory of the agent as a set of clips representing like percepts and actions, and they perform some random walks and then quantum walks through these clips. So maybe like in that case, that could be, maybe like one could think about neural networks in that case, but yeah, not in this one.
I have two questions. One is about your oracle. To implement it on your chip, you needed to know what was the true answer and what was the target, right?
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
So somehow you calculated before what was the true, and then, which means that you knew. So you don't need anything, actually. So my question is, do you really solve something here? In the sense that if you would need your oracle to be something that you don't know what it gives. And so...
Well, but that boils down to, it's a question about the Grover search, right? Rather than, so...
It's a question about, do you actually solve something here?
Mm. Yeah, well, yes, in the sense that you can program it and the chip does it for you, right? You don't...
Well, it gives you what you wanted, but you told him what you wanted.
Yeah, of course, but I'm telling it, do this automatically, right?
Let me rephrase. I think that in your case, you have more classical calculation before that needed to actually solve the problem when you start, just at the very beginning.
What do you mean? Like, if
you scale this up to thousands and thousands of things, which we know that won't happen soon, you would need to implement it the way you implemented it. You would need so much calculation that you would need actually to solve the problem, know exactly what is the action the agent should do before you actually run this thing.
Yes, but I would argue that this is true in general for many of these quantum experiments, right? I mean, there is always... No, I mean, my point is that there is... Okay, but in principle, I can also say... in the end, well, what did I do? I just send a photon either like up or down. I can also do this manually with a click, right?
It's common to play the Grover at all contexts.
Exactly. So.
No. Usually you have an algorithm to implement the oracle. But okay. That's what, and the second question is a bit more general. All these applications of quantum for machine learning, there's something I missed, that if you look at quantum computers, essentially, supposing that we make them work, they are good at giving you a few bits of information. Like you take all the resource estimates that have been done for chemistry or, I don't know, sure. You do a long calculation that will take, let's say, a day. And at the end, you get 50 bits or 2,000 bits if it's sure or something like that. So a few bits of information after a long time. So very little information at the end. And also, you can't give a lot of information at the beginning because that would take many, many, many gates. So essentially, there are low information. Maybe there is a lot of calculation, but in terms of amount of information, it's very small. I understand of machine learning, you know, you have these big things where you have a lot of information that gets out, a lot of information that gets in. So I'm just wondering whether this is really a good target for quantum computers in general, like just in terms of bandwidth, information bandwidth.
I didn't really think about this, but like the way I see it is that, so you're saying that, so if machine learning is a good target for quantum computing, or? I mean, the answer is, I don't think we know yet. I mean, you can like start like, investigating what happens if you like quantize this or quantize that, and then you can somehow play around and see, and then you say, okay, this particular aspect gives me something. If your question is more general, like if in the long term this is useful at all, I don't know, maybe, you know, there will be some issues for sure, but this is true for everything, I guess. This is also true for quantum computing, right? There's like so many issues that you may also think, okay, this is never gonna scale, this is never gonna work, and yet, you know, it's still worth investigating because something can will come up for sure. So, I mean, I see this more as a general question, and I understand the point, but it is still worth investigating, in my opinion.
Eliska.
Well, no, it's a super possession. Thanks, Valeria, for a super nice talk. I wanted to, can you go to the slide where you are comparing the quantum and classical rewards?
Yes.
Could you, yeah, perfect, thank you. Could you relate a little bit the value of the reward that you get to the actual experimental success? Because in the slope, you keep getting super high quantum rewards super quickly, but they are not as high as the classical asymptotical reward. So, how, like, is the reward opened for quantum part already enough that overall your experiment is successful?
Sorry, is the reward, can you repeat the last question? Is the reward?
That the reward 0.4 for a quantum part after whatever this is, 25 epochs, does that already mean that you are successful enough or you need to continue training this 500 epochs until you reach the asymptotic?
I see. Yeah. I mean, of course, this depends on your applications, right? Assuming you want to use this for an actual application, it depends. You may need... So, for example, you could envision a case where you need to search like very quickly, like through waveguides, and then in that case, yes, you will need to reach a certain, let's say, like you want to maximize the probability. But you could also envision cases where maybe like 0.4 or 0.5, whatever, is enough because like you're playing a different game. So it's completely, mm-hmm. It's completely arbitrary. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot also for this for the nice talk. I have one question which partly was addressed, I guess, already. It's about scalability a bit, not in terms of the hardware, but rather in terms of the principal idea of this whole quantum reinforcement learning algorithm, so which is based on being able to work with superpositions of states. And I guess you always have to measure on your hardware also like states in the end. And in the end, if you're now thinking about scaling this up to having not just a single qubit, but a lot of qubits, the measurement, I guess, might become an issue. It's a bit the question whether you see how the complexity scales of the measurement that you have to do in terms of the number of qubits that you have.
So the measurement at the end itself, I don't think that's the limiting factor. Because at the end, you always need just one measurement. You need to measure just once. And then whether you need to measure one output or 100 outputs, then it means you need either one detector or 100 detectors, which is actually not really a problem nowadays if you have enough money. The problem that I actually see with this specific platform is the scalability in terms of these integrated devices, because you can, so this was already impressive, this type of chip, right? As I said, it was a big thing, but again, you will need to error correct every single gate, right? So you need to perform some optimization protocols, and then of course, like the more of these waveguides you have, the more complicated it becomes. So in my opinion, actually, maybe this is not like really, if you want to keep implementing this, you would need to move to more scalable platforms, which I think could be, for example, playing with like color centers in silicon or diamond, for example. That's actually why I switched to that, because I see like more potential there, and I see that you can actually integrate even single photon sources there because that's your color center. And then if you, for example, have a memory, you can implement gates and you can have everything at the same chip. And I mean, in principle, this would be much more scalable.